American businesses, for that matter, businesses around the world, are being robbed of an estimated $12 to $13 billion a year by criminals who don't use conventional weapons to get the money. They use email. My guest today on No Password Required will describe a scam that is both very sophisticated, yet at its core, is also very simple. And perhaps most troubling of all, it's also very preventable. We'll also talk about how education can help prevent females from being victimized on the internet. We have a lot to share, and it's all coming up next on No Password Required.
No Password Required is a presentation of Cyber Florida, located on the Tampa campus of the University of South Florida.
Hello, I'm Bill McQueen, and this is No Password Required. My guest today is Stacy Aruda. She's a former FBI agent with more than 20 years of experience in cybersecurity. Since retiring from the FBI, Stacy has created the Aruda Group, a cybersecurity consultancy company. She's also a founding board member and the executive director of the nonprofit Florida Information Sharing and Analysis Organization. She's also a keynote speaker on numerous cybersecurity topics. Stacy, thank you for joining us on No Password Required.
Thank you very much for having me.
You describe one of the goals of the Aruda Group as educating industry and the public on the direct link between social media and cybercrime. Let's start there. How does that work? How does a social media post or tweet put us at risk?
Well, depending upon which articles you read on the internet, between 90 and 98% of all cybercrime begins with an email. So if you peel that back a little bit, you think to yourself, well, where are these criminals getting this information to email people to commit these cybercrimes? Well, the fraudsters go out and they troll the social media sites to try and come up or build a profile on an individual that they're looking to target, or if you go even further down the road, a company that they're trying to get into. So as citizens, we make it much easier for these criminals to victimize us by all of the information we post on the internet. And a lot of the things that's posted by itself is seemingly innocuous. Where you went to school, where you currently work. But if you take all of that information and you put it together, the bad guys, and by bad guys I mean terrorists, criminals, and spies, are able to build a profile on you. From that profile, they're able to craft emails that they can send to you that you will open, because the emails will look like they're familiar, or it look like something that is related to something that you do. But the bad guys take it one step further. They add some type of malicious code to that email, and in opening that email, now you have set your business up to be victimized, because once you open that email and you do whatever they ask you to do in that email, or depending upon the malicious code that's in the email, actually opening it may compromise the computer that you're on right now. And once the bad guy compromises one computer, remember that that bad guy is a hacker. They own the entire network.
So there's two avenues to pursue there. There's individuals and there's businesses. Let's look at individuals first.
Okay.
Can you give me an example or two of cases either that you worked or were aware of where what seemingly was innocuous information was put together and it led to a cybercrime?
Well, sure. So what the bad guys do in building the profile, they collect information, as I said before, where you went to school, what groups your interests are, groups that you belong to. So for example, I went to the University of Florida, and if the bad guy realizes I went to University of Florida, they could potentially send me an email with something related to UF or University of Florida football, because I'm a huge football fan, and I would open that because I'm interested in knowing what's going on with the football team at the University of Florida. So on a personal level, that could compromise my computer at home. On a business level, if we use our business email address for things that we shouldn't be using it for, like signing up for movie subscription services or online gaming, the bad guys can get the email address from that, and then they can send an email to your work that they've built the profile on, and make it look like it's coming from someone within your work environment. you're going to open that email, and then you've compromised your business email network.
Let's stay on the individual thing for a second. So someone compromises my email address. They have my email address. They get into my computer. What then? What can happen?
Well, there's a lot of things that they can do with your computer. Number one, they can steal your personally identifiable information, your PII, off of your computer. What is that? That is your social security number, your date of birth, all of the information that they would need to go and buy things or, create credit or that's one avenue. They can take your computer. They could take over your computer, and it could be what's called used as a bot, as a zombie in a botnet attack. So basically what would happen with that is your computer is controlled by somebody else and it sits dormant until the bad guy decides, oh, I want to attack this area over here. And it wakes up your computer and advises your computer to send tons and tons of traffic to the computer that he or she has chosen to be attacked. Also, your computer could be used as a pass-through. So when a bad guy breaks into a network or hacks into a computer network, they don't do it from their house straight to the victim. What they're going to do is they're going to go through various pass-throughs to obfuscate their identity. So your home computer could be used as one of those pass-throughs.
So ultimately finding the criminal and bringing them, that's very difficult because of what the way they've set things up, correct?
It can be very difficult. If a business knows that they've been victimized, they've had a computer intrusion or been the victim of some type of cybercrime, and they wait weeks to call law enforcement, there's really nothing law enforcement can do because the cyber trail is very, very volatile. The evidence has to be collected as quickly as possible.
So what do we do to protect ourselves? Again, as an individual, what do I do? What do I have my family do?
As an individual, for your home computer, we recommend that you practice something called defense in depth. So basically, it's the onion layer. It's the onion approach. So you want to make sure that your computer is patched and up to date. You want to make sure that you're running a firewall. You want to make sure that you have antivirus. You want to make sure that all of your passwords are good, strong passwords. And each one of those items works in conjunction with the other to build like a web or a net around your computer. So if the first item doesn't completely catch the threat, maybe the second or third will. Because any one of those items by themselves, it is not going to be as effective as those items taken together.
You're not the first cybersecurity professional to say that. In fact, people on this show have said that.
Right.
That information's been around for a long time about don't share too much information. Make sure you download all the patches and you basically use common sense. But there's still cybercrime. Why don't we patch our software? Why don't we heed advice about sharing information? Why are we continuing to do that?
Because we don't think it's going to happen to us. We see it happening to other people and say, I don't really have anything to steal, or, they're not going to break into my company because we don't offer anything that they could monetize or anything that anybody would want to steal. But what these companies don't understand is you have bandwidth, you have the ability for the bad guy to pass through your business. So it doesn't really matter what you have or you don't have. It's the ability to take over your network and utilize your network.
So you almost become an unwilling co-conspirator to someone who's using your computer.
Yeah, you're unwitting. An unwitting party. Exactly.
Okay. When we talked before the show, we talked by telephone before we recorded this, you said that people trade security for convenience. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. So you have a continuum. On one side is security, and on the other side is convenience. And when you get or you try to become more secure, it's less convenient. And people today are only interested in convenience. So when you add extra security on, employees complain. They don't want to use that multi-factor authentication because it's an extra step that they have to go through. That's just basically it. It's a trade-off.
In all your years as an FBI agent and now as a cybersecurity professional and consultant, Is it a high percentage of crimes or victimized people that if they'd have just done a couple of things, they would have prevented it?
Yes. Depending upon, again, which article you read on the internet, the majority of computer intrusions, data breaches, are the result of human error. And by human error, I mean misconfigured software, unpatched software, clicking on the wrong thing, not having a strong password. That's all human error. So if somebody were to send me an email, a spearfish email, and I click on that email because I'm not trained and I don't understand the consequences of clicking on that email, that's human error. Mm-hmm. So a good amount of cybercrime is the result of human error.
And it's not just individuals who put themselves in jeopardy by clicking on the wrong thing or not installing patches or sharing too much information. It also, as you mentioned, can happen to businesses. And we'll talk about that when No Password Required continues.
You're listening to No Password Required.
Welcome back to No Password Required. I'm Bill McQueen with Stacey Aruda, who's head of the Aruda Cybersecurity Consultancy Group. You were with the FBI for more than two decades. How and why did you become involved with cybersecurity?
Well, it's interesting. When I first came into the FBI, I worked Asian organized crime, Vietnamese gangs, and it was great. We worked 15, 16 hours a day chasing gang members and running up and down the streets all night long. But in 1999, the FBI decided that the internet was not going to go away. So they stood up 9 regional squads, and the office that I happened to be in had a regional squad. There was a lot of money that was thrown at this problem. There was training available, so I figured now would be a good chance to move over and try something different. It was very interesting. That's what drew me to it. So I've been working cybercrime since 1999, back in the old NIPSI days, the National Infrastructure Protection Center. So I kind of came in on the ground floor and have moved forward with it for the last 20-something years.
In the introduction to today's episode, I referred to a crime that's known as Business Email Compromise, or BEC. Mm-hmm. Can you describe for us briefly how BEC works and how it's tied to information that people may include in emails or things, human error, as you
sure.
described earlier, how criminals gain access through a BEC?
Okay, so if we go back to the amount of information that individuals post on the internet, these criminals, they look at this same information and they look for people to send these specific emails to compromise their machines. So the bad guys would be interested in compromising a CEO's machine or someone who is in accounts payable or human resources. So they can sit on those machines and they can watch and wait for invoices to come in that need to be paid. And they can either change the bank account routing information, or they can send an email acting as the client saying, hey, I've switched to a new bank. Or they can, from the CEO's machine, send an email to a subordinate in accounting and say, hey, we need to pay XYZ. And I have a very interesting example, if I could give it to you right now, about how this happened and how this one email cost the Nikkei $29 million. So in October of this year, a Nikkei America employee sent $29 million to a bad guy from an email that they received that they thought was from a management executive, but it really was not. It was from someone who was sitting on that individual's box, and they sent the email.
Is that money recoverable?
They say they're trying to recover it, but I'm going to say no.
Trying and getting it back are two different things.
Well, and the guys that are good at this know that if they have the money sent out of the United States to China or someplace like that, it's much harder mm-hmm. for the FBI to recover it. If the money is sent locally in the U.S. and it's realized that the money has been sent and the company contacts the FBI has what's called the Recovery Access Team, who has relationships with banks. And they can directly reach out to the bank and say, hey, look, this is fraudulent. Can you freeze the funds? And they've been very successful. Prior to the start of this team, the turnaround amount on getting the money back was maybe 20%. Now it's looking at like 75%. But it's all contingent upon when they call law enforcement. If you wait a week to call law enforcement, there's nothing we can do.
And I'm going to guess that could be a problem. Somebody realizes they just sent $29 million to the wrong person. How quickly are they going to want to run down the hall and tell their boss, look what I just did?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, there's a couple of examples in the state of Florida, too. But I just want to make sure that everybody understands that social media is tied to all of this cybercrime. So bad guys are pulling the information to build the profile to send an email. Once they send that email and you click on that email, bad guy has a lot of avenues that they can go down once they're sitting on the network. They can steal data. They can introduce ransomware and shut down the network. They can sit on the computers and they can wait for invoices to come in and wait for payments and steal money. There are a lot of different avenues they have, but if we didn't put so much information on the internet to begin with, it would make it a lot harder for bad guys to know that Bill Queen works in accounts receivable at XYZ company. Mm-hmm. So my point is employees need to be trained to understand that there's consequences to things that they do outside of work.
What was one of the examples you said that occurred here in Florida?
Okay, so I have two. One happened in August in Naples. An employee sent $700,000 to a bad guy after the bad guy changed the bank account. So an invoice comes in. The money is supposed to be routed to Bank A. Bad guy is sitting on the employee's machine. And unbeknownst to the employee, bad guy changes routing number for the bank account. And as this payment is going to be paid, it doesn't go to Bank A, it goes to Bank B. And with these type of events, companies don't usually find out about it until the company that is supposed to get that money realizes that they haven't been paid.
So that could be 30, 45, 60 days maybe.
Oh, it's usually a couple of days. If you owe a company, if a company's waiting for a $700,000 wire transfer.
Okay, so they're not going to wait 60 days.
No, but they're going to wait.
But the clock is running.
The clock is running. Okay. And the second one that I had just happened in Ocala. Ocala contracted with a construction company to do work on their airport. And the Ocala government, and a government employee sent the $742,000 payment to a bad guy rather than the construction company. And the construction company reached out to the Ocala government and said, hey, where's our money? We can't move forward without the money. And they're like, oh, we already sent that. And they're like, no, you didn't. So they had to backtrack and they found out that, you know, the money was rerouted.
So BEC attacks are highly targeted. It's not like you hear about some hacks where they gathered information on several hundred thousand people. These are very targeted attacks, correct?
Yes.
And for the most part, or maybe completely, it's all about money. It's not about revenge or going in just to mess with a company. They're after money.
They're absolutely after money. Yes. And I have another example, if we could quickly talk about that. This one happened last month or came to light in Spain. Three individuals were charged. And this one is different because it's a very sophisticated network. So these three individuals had 185 email accounts set up to be able to basically go in and change accounts and get money. And they used 80 shell companies to funnel the money through. So it wasn't like, you know, I sent you an email and you clicked on the email and I owned your computer and, you know, I diverted $5,000. These guys diverted $11 million.
So these are sophisticated attacks. This isn't someone.
Some are. Like this, the one in Spain, that was a sophisticated network.
Organized crime, foreign states, who's doing it for the most part?
Well, with regard to cybercrime, it's not traditional organized crime. It's loosely knit organized crime. So you have criminal groups that may actually be on different continents and may not even know each other's real names, but they know each other from the internet. They know of their internet monikers, their nicks, and they come together with one purpose in mind, and that's to make money. Steal what we can steal and monetize it.
You have, in talking, you said that this is a highly preventable crime. And we've touched on that a little bit, but explain when you say it's highly preventable. How so?
Okay, so it's interestingly enough, I had a conversation with a partner from a local law firm not long ago, and he said, this is what keeps him up at night, this business email compromise. And I looked at him and kind of scratched my head, and I said, this is completely preventable on your end. You guys bill for everything. So you get an email from a client who says, hey, I want to change my bank account to X. Okay. Open up your book with your contact information. Call the client and verify. Don't call the client based upon the phone number that's in the email. Call the client based upon the phone number that you have that you know to be true and say, are you changing your email address or your bank account? Or have you changed anything? That would stop that right there.
Is that another example of where we're putting convenience?
Yes, sir.
Over security?
Yes, sir. It's inconvenient to do that.
Do you find in your experience as an FBI agent and now as a consultant that business owners are reluctant to share information or report a crime because they're afraid it's going to hurt their bottom line or their reputation? Or is that changing? Are people more forthcoming now with, hey, we've been victimized?
No. They don't want it to get out because they don't want to be seen as weak. And it all comes down to if it's a publicly traded company, they don't want their stock value to drop. There's been occasions where consultants have been called in, something has happened, and the company just wants to know what has happened, and that's the end of it. They don't want to move forward. They don't want to prosecute. They just want it to quietly go away.
Are they interested, though, in not making sure it happens again? I mean, that would seem to be the logical step is how do we prevent this from happening again?
A lot of times logic doesn't play into this. They just want it to quietly go away.
Okay, so let's say I'm a business owner. How do I protect myself? What advice do you give me as a consultant?
Well, the first thing I'm going to look at is are your employees trained? Do you have or do you foster a culture of security at your environment? What's your organizational culture like? A lot of times you go to companies and you talk to employees and they'll tell you, well, I'm not responsible for security. That's the IT people's job. Or I'm not responsible for physical security. That's the guard outside. That's not true. Everybody in the organization is responsible for security, whether it be physical or cyber. I mean, if you go back to 9/11, when it was very, very vogue, if you see something, say something. We need to continue with that mentality. I gave a great example at a talk that I had the other night. This was many years ago. I'm getting in my car. I'm getting ready to leave the FBI office. And as I'm trying to go out, I see a vehicle is parked in the exit with the doors open and the motor running. And I'm like, whoa. Okay, so that's strange on its face. But the day before, there was a threat to the Miami office of the FBI that somebody was going to blow it up. So that elevated the threat there. So if you see something, say something. You need to stop. If it's out of the ordinary, you need to report it. If your computer is acting strange or you've clicked on something that you think maybe you shouldn't have clicked on, you need to take the network cable out of the back of the computer and then call somebody. Don't hope that it will go away, because if you take those two steps, so maybe there's 2, 3, 4 computers that are infected rather than 300.
What should a business do if they are a victim, they are hacked, and information, they are compromised? What should they do?
Well, I'm hoping that they have an incident response plan, and they go to their incident response plan, and they exercise what's in that plan. There are six areas that need to be in an incident response plan, and in the first area, in the preparation, the decision whether or not to call law enforcement has to be made prior to the event, and it has to be in the book. Everybody's jobs and responsibilities has to be laid out in the plan. You have to also have some type of relationship with an incident response company, because when you're in the thick of it, that's not the time to call an incident response company and say, how much are you going to charge me? We're hemorrhaging data. Because it's like sharks with blood in the water. They see an opportunity, they're going to seize it. So you need to have a good incident response plan, execute the plan, and then go forward.
A lot of companies have fire drills. They have more and more companies, unfortunately, have, if there's an active shooter, they have drills. Mm-hmm. What do? Do you find most companies have a response plan for a cyber attack?
They should. Some, you talk to them and they're like, well, what is that? That after training, you need to have it. You need, your employees need to be trained. You need to have that security culture, foster that. But you also have to have a competent IT team. And there has to be buy-in from the C-suite that cybersecurity is a priority.
And that it's an attack.
Right.
It's an assault on the company and needs to be treated as such.
And all of that is laid out in your plan. So in your plan, you need to have two paths, whether or not it's a cyber incident or a cyber event. One is an anomalous type one-off thing. You go to the right. If it's a full-on attack, there's a breach, you're hemorrhaging data, you go to the left, and you proceed as it's laid out in the plan.
Posting too much information or inappropriate information on social media and the internet can pose other dangers. More on that when No Password Required continues.
You're listening to No Password Required.
We're back on No Password Required. I'm Bill McQueen with my guest, cybersecurity expert Stacey Aruda. One of your topics as a keynote speaker, is educating women on how not to be victimized on the internet. Specifically, what do you mean by that?
Well, again, it boils down to the amount of information that you post on the internet and the amount of information that you make accessible for the world to see. What a lot of people fail to understand is that www equals World Wide Web, not my small group or my high school or my business associates. It's World Wide Web. I am currently working on a book basically to illustrate how to keep women safe online and women of all ages. There's an interesting phenomena with our youth of today. They feel that it is extremely necessary to gain acceptance and approval from people that they don't even know. So they are basically driven by the number of likes and comments that they get on items that they post on Instagram or Snapchat or items like that. And I just don't understand why we've become so insecure as a society.
And you, specifically women, you find that they're more often victimized than, say, young men? Or
yes, for two reasons. One, young women are looking for something. They're looking for that approval. They're looking for something that young men are not looking for. But young men are, it's very, very hard for them to come forward if they've been victimized.
And you say women of all ages. I mean, we're talking about younger women, but women of all ages.
Yeah, so there's different things that each, like, generational age gap should do to keep themselves safer online. And in my book, I break it down into, like, teens, dating singles, business women, moms, and our great senior gals.
Is there a common theme, though, among all those that you could give one or two things that do not do this, or here's something you definitely should do to keep yourself safe?
Yes. Stop posting your entire life and movements online. It's counterproductive to you. It's counterproductive to your family. I mean, we have lost the whole concept of community as a society. You know, the days of block parties and your neighbors, you know, your neighbors popping over at any time are really kind of gone. But we have no qualms about detailing our vacation real time online. And basically what you're, by doing that, you're letting the entire world know that your house is empty.
And you read about women, young women mm-hmm. mostly, who are trolled on the internet. Mm-hmm. And you think of it, well, that's harassment. But it can lead to physical danger. Am I correct?
Absolutely. So I worked the online exploitation of children for a long time. We saw the bad guys go after boys and girls of all ages, you know, from 18 down. But a lot of times it was easier to target some children over others because of the amount of information that was on the internet. I'll give you a quick example. So we worked a case one time where a young girl, a 9-year-old girl, was in a chat room where she was playing a game. And in the game, you could chat. It was controlled chat, what you could say, you know, click on a box and to back and forth. Well, she was chatting with a person who she assumed was another 9-year-old child who was not. And the individual, the predator, was able to get her off of that chat room into another chat room where there were no restrictions. And he was able to get the girl's mother's email address from the girl. Well, the girl's mother's email address was first name, last name, at whatever. Well, bad guy's not dumb. Bad guy goes out and Googles mom's name and finds out that mom has a website. Okay, bad guy goes to mom's website. Oh, look at that. On mom's website is a little girl in her elementary school t-shirt. So bad guy, we assume, starts calling the elementary school to find out what the security's like at the school, what time school lets out, and it starts to escalate. We get involved and we're able to intercede. But as this grooming process was moving forward, the bad guy was looking towards possibly grabbing this child.
We talked about protecting yourself a little bit, but you've led into another area. It's not just about protecting yourself. Mm-hmm. You're a mom. You have 3 children.
Yep.
We have to look out for our kids. What do you tell your children about internet safety and social media safety?
Well, my children, fortunately, are a little bit older now, but when they were younger, they were not allowed to post anything until I saw it. So I didn't restrict what accounts they could have. I had to be able to see what they had, and they were okay with that. And like my daughter, she would post pictures of her and her friends at the beach or here or there or whatever. But before she posted something, she would ask me if it was appropriate, which I think is fine. But I think what we've gotten away from, too, is if our kids are quiet, then, you know, everything's okay. That's really not the time that it's okay. When they're quiet, that's the time you need to inquire as to what they're doing. So we kind of have moved into an age of where we let technology babysit our children, which is not a very good idea. And the advice that I give to parents is whatever piece of technology you deploy to your children, you need to have that same piece of technology and you need to know how to use it and you need to know how to exploit it to look through it and know exactly what your kids are doing.
But things have changed from the days where your children would communicate by telephone. It was there in the house.
Right.
Now, the internet, social media, Twitter, it's all mobile.
Mm-hmm.
How does a parent monitor that? How does a parent make sure that their child isn't doing something that could endanger them? What kind of advice do you give parents about that?
Well, there's different companies that sell monitoring software for cell phones, for computers, for whatever. And you put that software on and it runs in the background and it sends you reports. It tells you what websites your kids have gone to. It gives you their usernames and passwords for the different apps or whatever they're going to. It also sends you a report of their emails and things like that. And, you know, I've heard from parents, but that's a violation of their privacy. They're kids. They don't have any privacy rights. It's your job as a parent to keep them safe. You have no qualms about searching their room for paraphernalia. Why would you not search some item that your children have access to, like the scary guy at the mall? You wouldn't let your kids walk up to that scary guy, but by giving them a phone or a computer and not monitoring what they're doing, you're allowing the scary guy in your house.
We're almost out of time. You've been involved in cybersecurity and protecting businesses, protecting yourself, protecting your children for more than two decades. Mm-hmm. Is there one or two things, takeaways, that you've learned from all your experience that you'd want to share with us?
Sure. Like I talked about earlier, defense in depth is going to be your key to protecting your home computer. Thinking before you post is going to protect you personally. It's going to protect your children. You should monitor what your kids do and know what they're posting. Know who they're talking to on the internet, because kids think that, you know, the world is all sunshine and rainbows, and the individual that they're talking to at the other end of that Snapchat or who's commenting on their Instagram pictures is a kid that's their same age, and a lot of times it's not.
Before we go, you're also a founding board member and executive director of the Florida Information Sharing and Analysis Organization for Cybersecurity. Briefly, what's the purpose of that group and how does it work?
The purpose of the Florida ISOW is to raise cyber resiliency in the state of Florida, and that is basically through promoting information sharing, threat intelligence reports, and just basically helping, you know, the small to mid-sized business, local government, kind of get up to speed with cybersecurity, because they don't really have the budget that the big companies have to be able to, you know, put hundreds of thousands of dollars into hardening their network.
If someone wants to get in contact with you, either through either for the Aruda Group or for the Organization for Cybersecurity, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
My email address is info at arudagroup.com. That's ArrudaGroup.com.
Sounds good. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Stacy Aruda of the Aruda Group and the Executive Director of Florida's Information Sharing and Analysis Organization for Cybersecurity. I'm Bill McQueen. Thank you for joining us on this edition of No Password Required.
No Password Required is a presentation of Cyber Florida, located on the Tampa campus of the University of South Florida. To hear other episodes of No Password Required, visit cyberflorida.org/podcast.